Okay, let's get started.
Thanks.
Welcome to Michigan Statehood Day, which makes today's topic unbelievably appropriate. Let me do a few announcements. My name is John Beck, and I co-direct our Daily Work, Our Daily Lives. What I'm going to send around is, as every year I always had to remind people that not all the talks are on Friday. And indeed, a week from today, Maria Katera from American Studies and Women's Studies over at the University of Michigan on the main campus in Ann Arbor is going to be doing a talk called Working for Justice, Legacies of Latina Activism in Southeastern Michigan, which is based on Maria's oral histories with a number of Latina activists in Detroit, many of whom were connected to the labor movement in a variety of different ways. Also, the balance of the season, let me point out that the sharp-eyed Dorothy McMeekin has ferreted out that I put two things down as Fridays when they were actually a Monday and a Thursday. So if you have a white one of these, tear it up and use it for something else. But we're very happy to have a number of wonderful things coming up in March and April. Also in February, boy, that is really going to be an interesting noise. We have our first nighttime lecture that's connected to the current exhibit, Seeing China, and I'll send those around. Gorgeous, gorgeous exhibit of photographs, many of which are work and labor centered down in the main gallery downstairs. But Philip Ritterman is doing a talk at 7 o'clock February 23rd, you'll see on the back talk, the back side of that, in this very room called Emperor's River, photographing along China's Grand Canal. It's all about photographing workers along the Grand Canal as a subtext. And if you haven't seen the exhibit, do stop in and come back and hear Phil Ritterman on February 23rd. Which brings us to today. You know, many of us met Eric Nordberg first when he was at Michigan Technological University's archives up in the Copper Country. And Eric was one of the finest real spark plugs to spur all of the different labor history that came out of the Copper Country. Many of us have either worked in his archive or presented at his various conferences. I've been connected to my wonderful colleague who's here today, John Rivette, who did one of the first labor, both slideshows and then video and booklet, things from Calumet to Kalamazoo. The Calumet really has to do with today's talk that Eric is going to be giving, which is on the 1913 Michigan copper strike. But Eric took a temporary position, it turned out, with the Michigan Humanities Council as director, but had, as he would say, the dream job open up, which is director of the Reuther Library in Detroit. For those of you who don't know about the Reuther, it is the place to do original labor research based on all of the wonderful, wonderful things that they've archived there. So go down to Detroit and check out the Reuther sometime. The Reuther Archive and Library is really quite spectacular. It's right on the campus at Wayne State University. So Eric took that dream job, left us and, you know, all of us in Lansing, and he and Jane went off to the southern climes down in Detroit. So Eric did a version of this presentation earlier for the Centennial Conference on the 1913 Michigan Copper Strike last year. I was happy to give a couple presentations at that conference as well. But we are so happy to have Eric here, who today is talking on the topic At Home Along the Picket Line, Company Housing in the 1913 Michigan Copper Strike. So please help me welcome Eric Nordberg.
Thanks. Well, what a great introduction. Can everybody hear me okay? I'm hoping that my sound is getting picked up. As John said, I had a sojourn here in Lansing for a couple of years, and glad to speak on this topic. I actually published an article on this material in the Mining History Association's annual journal. So at the end, I'll have my email address. You can always contact me if you'd like reference to that, or just go and look for the Journal of the Mining History Association that picked up this work. The provision of company housing in mining districts has actually drawn a fair amount of inquiry over time. Mining historians, community planners, architectural historians, academics are very interested in this role that corporate paternalism, that corporate welfare plays in places like remote mining districts. So this is not a topic that I single-handedly located. That said, it's a topic that has not still had much additional work. I know John Rivette has a copy of Kim Hoagland's recent publication, Mine Towns, which I can highly recommend, a very expert work one worth pursuing. Housing is often built of necessity in these kinds of remote areas. And so some people don't think of it necessarily as a piece of corporate welfare, but as you'll see in the remarks today, for many districts, this is a very significant element of corporate welfare and a very important non-wage employment benefit that becomes part of a compensation package that plays into all sorts of different areas. I want to specifically today talk about the role that company housing played in the 1913 Western Federation of Miners strike in the Copper Country, but I think the lessons learned here are significant across the board as far as this aspect of corporate welfare. For those that are not familiar with Michigan's Copper Country, the very far northwestern portion of Michigan and the very far northwestern portion of the Upper Peninsula is a little jagged piece of land that sticks up into Lake Superior known as the Keweenaw Peninsula. That's the center of a historic copper mining district, one of the world's most significant deposits of native copper, so copper in its metallic form in the ground. And Native Americans actually were able to use copper from the outcroppings of these deposits as early as 3,000 years ago. And Keweenaw copper is known to have traded as far south as the Mississippi River lowlands, as far east as the Atlantic Ocean, and as far west as the Pacific Ocean. So a very important piece of trade material for Native Americans. Meanwhile, settling communities discovered this area, and a mining district using what were then at the time modern mining efforts began in the 1840s in this area. And so from the perspective of white settlers and others who came to the area to exploit these mineral riches, the modern era comes in the 1840s. The district was very successful. By the late 1890s, it was producing over 100 million pounds of copper per year. It was leading the United States and the world in copper production. It was only surpassed as low-grade ore deposits in the American West opened up in places like Utah and Arizona. But Michigan copper continued to play a significant role, and in fact, some claim that trace elements of silver in this native copper deposit made it more amenable to conductivity and use in electricity and other types of alloys. So it continued to be a very significant part of the world's metal-producing activities. Cities like Calumet, Hancock, and Houghton, as a result, developed surprisingly characteristic qualities of urban areas. Although you were in the middle of nowhere from many people's perspectives, a town like Calumet, as you can see in the picture here, developed very significant infrastructures, road infrastructures, utility infrastructures, cities and towns. In amongst all of that, of course, was a large number of employees that came into this region to support this mining activity, who also required housing, required churches, required all of the infrastructures that we expect from communities. The region's most significant labor unrest came in 1913 in July when miners put down their tools and began a strike that was to last for almost an entire year until April of 1914. The men were organized by the Western Federation of Miners, who had their origins in the copper district of Butte, Montana, but had grown to national prominence. Although the WFM had a radical reputation in its early period, by the time it was organizing in Michigan, it had become a little more conservative under the leadership of Charles Moyer. I say conservative in relative terms to some of the radicalism of that period. And the union set out to organize the Midwestern mining camps. Michigan Copper, although there had been attempts at unionization and some small success, the various iron mining districts around the Lake Superior region had experienced probably a little bit more radicalization and union movement. The Copper Country had never had significant unionization, so this was the most significant effort to organize in that region. Obviously, there was a lot at stake. At that time, there were 15,000 employees in Michigan copper mines, and then looking at Marquette, at the emerging Mesabi Range, and two or three other iron mining ranges in the Lake Superior region, maybe as many as another 20 to 25,000 miners in the iron community. So the Western Fed took this very seriously. Their goals were pretty common to that time, five demands that they had, an 8-hour day, a minimum wage, grievance system, recognition of the union. Somewhat unique to the Copper Country also was issues about a new drilling technology. Up to this point, about 1910, most of the copper mines in the region utilized a two-man drilling system, and the companies had discovered a one-man drill that was light enough and nimble enough for one man to move. Miners felt that there were safety issues at play, since a two-man team would allow two men to kind of keep an eye on each other if there were safety concerns. As you can imagine, the company realized that a one-man drill would cut their mining workforce in half and really reduce their costs. So that was one of the significant pieces at play here. At the outset of this strike, several state and federal agencies attempted to arbitrate the dispute. The governor at that time, Woodbridge Ferris, sent National Guard troops to the region. They arrived within 24 hours of the original announcement, which would be even hard today, I think, to get National Guard to Calumet and the Copper Country in 24 hours. Ferris opened communications with mine operators, particularly at that time the leader in this region was the Calumet and Hecla Copper Company, and its president, a gentleman named James McNaughton, was seen as kind of the leader of the mining management side. He was a very significant person in the Copper Country, very significant person in metals markets at the time. They all approached McNaughton and the other managers seeking some sort of resolution or discussion. I believe McNaughton's comment was he would see grass grow in the streets of Calumet before he would recognize the union. So it was clear from the onset that this was going to be potentially a very bitter dispute. Ferris's response then was to send the circuit court judge from Wayne County, a gentleman named Alfred Murphy, up to Calumet in early August. He made a visit there, talked to mine owners, talked to the union members, and sent a report back in late August indicating that this dispute was not going to be settled easily and that it was probably going to be lengthy in nature. He believed that the strikers had reasonable grievances, but it was clear that the mine managers were not going to recognize the union or give in to these pieces. I think the greatest fear for the union side on this whole piece was that as August became September and September became fall and fall became winter, the idea of a strike lasting through one of the Copper Country's notoriously long winters was not boding well for the striking miners at that time. The Western Federation, interestingly enough, turned to the federal government for help. This is July, August of 1913. Well, in March of 1913, the federal government had created the Department of Labor with the intention that that was going to be an office, cabinet-level office, that was going to assist with understanding and smoothing relationships between unions and management from the federal level. The Secretary of Labor at that time, William Wilson, appointed a man named John Moffitt from his Bureau of Immigration to work on this strike. So Moffitt went up to the Copper Country, but more importantly, for my story, brought in a gentleman named Walter B. Palmer. And Palmer was kind of given the job of going into the Copper Country in more detail, gathering information that the federal government, the Department of Labor, could use to understand this situation in more detail. And so in search of establishing some baseline statistic data, Palmer did this great thing. He sent out a questionnaire with 110 questions to each of the major mining companies in the copper country at that time, and requiring, as the federal government, that they respond to these queries with detailed information. And my background, if John hadn't mentioned it, is that I'm an archivist as much of a historian, and it's great when you find these kinds of questionnaires that survive. And so really, that was the key part that Palmer played, was that he gathered this information. And that information, for the most part, survives in archives in various parts of the state and in the federal government as well. Included were questions that covered really the whole gamut of mining company operations in the region. Everything from working conditions underground, production statistics, wage tiers at the time, grievance procedures that were in place already outside of union structures. And from his study, he produced a report that came out entitled Michigan Copper District Strike. And this was actually published as a U.S. Senate document at the time. That was the way that a lot of federal reports came out in serial. And this actually was released in November, late November of 1913. Interestingly enough, the report included lots of different things, including statistics and other documentation about the strike and working conditions. It also included a lot of information about company housing in the region. Palmer very clearly understood that housing was an important part of what was going on in this relationship between workers and management in the copper country. Palmer's questionnaire actually also requested that mining companies submit photographs with the report, with the questionnaire that they did. Although photographs don't appear in this publication that came out of the government, the photographs survived with the questionnaires. And so they were very much available to those who were studying this issue. In his report, Palmer counted more than 3,000 houses that were owned by mining companies in the four counties of Houghton, Keweenaw, Ontonagon, and Baraga. And so 3,000 families that were occupying these structures, mine workers and others across the district. Some of these range from very small two-room log cabins built very early in the period to even larger houses that were built at that time. I can go into detail about houses, but I don't know if you're an architectural history crowd. I certainly encourage you to look at Kim Hoagland's book. She gets a little bit more into that, and I don't want to bog us down with measurements and structures. But lots of different variety in company housing stock in this region, both as a reflection of the long period of time that they were being produced, but also the range of employees. This isn't just the two, the gentlemen working underground. They built housing for shift bosses, for mine managers. My wife and I had a house that the Tamarack Mining Company built for their mining engineer that was about 3,000 square feet, still owned by a mining company. So quite a range of housing stock that was available at the time. The photo here actually shows some of those smaller log dwellings. These would have two rooms on the lower level, a small attic space. They often built a shed addition off the back to give it that salt box appearance. Other houses were just built as salt boxes. Actually, some men preferred these houses. They were smaller for a small family. They were more than sufficient, and they were incredibly cheap to rent, cheaper even than other houses that the company provided. You can get an idea of some of the larger houses that were built. This is a seven-room dwelling at the Tri-Mountain Mine south of Houghton. Buildings of this style might be a little bit larger, include a basement, a living room, kitchen, dining room, and even up to four second-floor bedrooms. Small bedrooms, but four separate rooms that would be there. Also, classic Copper Country basements here that are often built 2 to 3 feet above grade just to deal with heavy snow loads in the winter. So you very often see those. None of the mines required workers to live in houses. None of them made it a requisite that if you were employed by the company, you had to live in one of their homes and pay whatever outrageous rents they had. Quite the opposite, many workers wanted to be in a company house because it was a popular perquisite of employment in this district. The companies kept their monthly rents very low. It might be $1 a room per month, or maybe a maximum of $5 a month to rent an entire house from the company. Considering that the company's average construction of a new dwelling might be $1,000, you can clearly see that the companies did not see this as a quick return on their investment. They were not looking at these being part of a money-generating activity. Company housing also played in several important events during the Michigan 1913 copper strike. The house that you're seeing here is in a mining location just south of Houghton, just south actually of Painesdale, called Seaberville. During the strike, August 14th of 1913, deputies who were, there were a lot of quasi-police forces that were empowered during this time, followed some strikers who they felt were trespassing on company property, and a fracas ensued, and shots were fired into this house, killing two Croatian miners during that time. And then actually not far away from this site, this house was the home of the Daly, Thomas Daly and his wife, and supposedly a group of striking miners fired into this house that included some Cornish workers who were still on the job, killing three people in this case. So mining company housing becomes very central to what's going on. You know, companies gained a lot of benefits from this system. Palmer himself inferred that low rents were designed to retain stable workers and to offer lower salaries, and I'm quoting from his report. The very low rent is an advantage to the employees that are married, and one reason of the companies for making the rents low is to hold the married men. They considered married men to be more reliable than single men, more apt to work regularly, and not so apt to leave the employment of the company to work for another mining company in the area. However, single men claim that married men are to some extent compensated for low wages by this housing arrangement. But low rents are of no benefit to a single man. And so there were issues at play here, very much about attracting and retaining what they felt was a stable married workforce. Provide low rent housing that's at a good quality, and a worker who has a family is going to be more attached and maybe a bit more loyal in their relationship with the company. Other things were included in this relationship as well as low rents. Some companies provided free garbage pickup, sometimes twice a week, that they would come by and collect garbage from your home. Many came and cleaned privies with company men. They also very often offered to deliver coal at prices that were below cost because the companies were buying coal in bulk. Families were very often encouraged to rent vacant rooms in their home to other boarders, particularly single men who were in the system, therefore kind of providing some stability, calming influence perhaps for single men who might otherwise go to a boarding house and become a radical labor organizer. They also allowed families to pasture livestock, and as you can see in this picture, have gardens on company property. As the region began to mature, a lot of consolidation occurred in this area. And so as companies began to grow, particularly the Calumet and Hecla, but others as well, and began to buy up the controlling shares in other companies, they would find themselves often saddled with the maintenance of a new bevy of houses that they didn't build and that might be quite older than they are. Calumet and Hecla in particular ended up owning more than a dozen properties, including the Amique, Centennial, Isle Royal, LaSalle, North and South Kearsarge, Osceola, Superior, and Tamarack. This is a photo of some houses at the Tamarack mine. Many of these houses were quite old, and so suddenly the companies were gaining properties that had much higher maintenance costs. Most of these homes were not built with running water, were not built with electricity, but as the district emerged into that era, many new homes were built with those amenities, and not surprisingly, employees asked for them to be brought into older homes, again, at sometimes high cost to the company. In the end, annual maintenance budgets were almost always set to income from lease and rent payments. And so as these number of houses grew, it was became increasingly difficult for companies to kind of keep up with maintenance and improvement as they went along. Excuse me. CNH itself had over 700 houses across the region here. Also, companies were involved in other aspects of community. Here's a boarding house that the Isle Royal Mining Company built. Boarding houses were still common across the enterprise. There's been some good research done on boarding house life. But again, this desire for single family homes had lots of input. I think Hoagland in her book makes a very good argument that low rent houses become also an avenue for immigrants to enter the market, save money with the goal of home ownership. And in fact, she follows in one of her chapters there, the families that were affected in the Sieberville shooting, the Puttrich family, who eventually left the Copper Country and had gained enough financial resource while they were in the Keweenaw to buy a home in Illinois when they moved. So larger themes at play as well. Companies also allowed ground rents, which meant that a mining company employee could come and lease a piece of property, in some cases to build their own home on company property. And in fact, throughout the mining company records that survive at Michigan Tech, you'll always find lists not only in the mining company records, but even on the tax rolls for employee houses on company land. They also had farm leases where for a very small amount of money, maybe $5 a month, an employee could have a 40-acre plot to either farm or pasture animals in. These rentals were not without significant liability, as you can imagine, to the employees. Palmer also in his questionnaire and in his report indicated that most employees signed leases that stipulated that the tenant, quote, had no right to possession beyond 15 days after he quit employment or was released from the company. So that any cause or reason whatsoever, if the man left the company, they could put a tenant out of a house, a rented house. Also, in the case of ground rents, where an employee built a house on company property, they had 90 days to remove the house from the piece of property. Or, as the lease indicated very clearly, the house, quote, shall fully vest in and become the property of the mining company. Palmer was very disconcerted by this. He identified at least 1,100 houses across the district that were built on company land that relied on these kind of leases. So obviously during a strike, it would be a concern that you were no longer an employee of the company. As far as design went, the companies did try to provide some variety in design. These are some what I think are cute little gambrel roof houses that are built in the southern part of the Calumet area. Again, each of the housing sizes had a different variety of rooms and spaces. I think actually even if you go to the Copper Country today, even with modifications to buildings afterwards, it's still a more diverse community than some mining company towns in the coal mining regions of the east. But construction patterns created this kind of stylistic checkerboard that you expect now in company towns. This neighborhood has gambrel houses. If you look in the background on the left, you can see some gable-roofed houses, and it's kind of fun to drive around. During the early months of the strike, mine operators declared that they would not evict striking miners. That was at least their initial play. Early in September, as the strike was beginning to become something that didn't seem to have an easy resolution, the mining companies began to change their position and began to talk about eviction, started to actually serve eviction notices. Thankfully for the working man of Houghton County, they had a few years earlier elected a very populist circuit court judge, a gentleman named Patrick O'Brien. O'Brien was kind of on their side within the law, and I think his feeling was that evictions shouldn't be a tool that management could use to resolve the strike. That's the one thing that he was most adamant against. So he was very encouraging for miners to bring appeals against eviction, to lengthen processes against which they could argue that they were or were not currently on the employment rolls. And O'Brien was also one who, as strikers were being arrested during strike marches, he pretty much let them go as soon as they had a hearing. So that was not an avenue, at least in this case, that the companies could use. That said, though, the companies were becoming more strident about this as the fall came. And they knew that the winter was going to be a piece that was going to give them more power, particularly as housing went. I had a document here from the Quincy Mining Company indicating, you know, their eviction notices that were issued in September, October, November. They went from 10 in September to 65 and 75 in November, December. So they were actively looking at this. Those were again being bogged down in some procedural matters within the court. But Quincy in particular was very indicative to its workforce and to the public at large that mining company housing was a perquisite to be provided to those who were working for the company. And they did not see striking miners as being in that category. And they were ready to release them. With that in mind, and with the winter coming and the winter passing, and some other events which I won't go into in detail here that you would be aware of, the Western Federation of Miners leadership became less supportive of the mine, of the mining strike. By February of 2014, they became very cautious about their financial ability to support the striking miners. And in fact, the eviction notices were now beginning to look as if they were going to be allowed. And the Western Federation of Miners leadership was also very concerned that they would not be able to support what could have been up to 4,000 families who would have been evicted from homes across the copper country. Those were some of many of the issues that ultimately led the strike to come to its close in Easter, early April of 1914. But Palmer's work actually has other influences that are worth understanding. In particular, the photographic material had a life beyond his work and his piece. Here's a good photo of a house in the Osceola location, a set of housing that are part of the Palmer photographs. You may also notice the same photo in the upper right in this picture. Other Western Federation of Mine locals were very initially supportive of their Michigan brethren. In fact, they raised $700,000 for a Michigan defense fund during the summer of 1913. But some of their enemies in labor and management, or excuse me, in mine management in the copper country, always knew that there could be questions that they could bring to them. So a group of mine operators got together and published their own book using the photographs that Palmer had compiled as part of his work. They called themselves the Copper Country Commercial Club. It was later discovered that they were in fact funded by Calumet and Hecla, Quincy, and the Copper Range companies. And published this nice little booklet. I wish I had a copy to share. It was not as text-oriented as the Department of Labor report. It included a lot of photographs. And in addition to the housing photographs, it highlighted other things that were part of the corporate welfare system in the copper country. Schools, libraries, buildings that were freely available to members of the community here. Also, photographs of other buildings, YMCA, National Guard armories, other structures that the company paid for, that the company allowed pieces of real estate to be used for, that helped, I think, miners in other districts see what was going on here. Yes, Michigan miners were being paid less in wages. Those numeric figures were indisputable in comparison to other mining districts, but the photographs of the corporate largesse, the communities, the style and the quality of the housing. These books were not produced for distribution in the copper country. They were taken to Butte, Montana. They were taken to Arizona. They were taken to other places where the Western Federation of Mines had locals. Not surprisingly, interest in supporting the strike waned. Here's even a photograph of Tamarack Hospital. Medical care in the copper country was actually pretty good for its time through these kinds of programs In the region, mining companies did not operate stores. They were actually very supportive of cooperatives and other types of commercial market options. Again, their feeling was if you kept prices down through good cooperative pricing, then you didn't have to pay men as much in a wage packet. As the details of the conditions began to circulate, many of the non-Michigan unions began to question their need to send money. And there's been good research that has drawn on letters and material outside of Michigan to show that these documents distributed. And in particular, members of the Butte local, the original founding local of the Western Federation of Miners, quote, were fast becoming undeceived concerning the merits of the strike in the copper country. Their men were becoming angry with Western Federation of Mines officials, and quote, those men so long pulled the wool over our eyes in regards to the conditions in Michigan. Wages in Montana were higher, but Butte miners were suffering higher living costs, including monthly rents as high as $27 to $30 a month in comparison to $5 a month in Michigan. Anaconda, which was the big operator in Butte, was unwilling to provide land for miners to build their own homes, so they didn't have that sort of an option. And that resentment boiled to the point where Butte Local Number 1 actually left the Western Federation of Miners, which spelled in the end the end of the Western Federation of Miners as a union. I guess in conclusion, it's difficult to precisely gauge exactly the role that company housing played through this delayed arrival into labor unionism in the Michigan Copper District. But I think during this 1913 strike, it's very clear that it had an important role in the thinking of mining companies as they were beginning to look at evictions, but also in the thinking of workers and unions as far as how they were going to be able to control this piece. It was hard to ignore photographic material, which had been collected by Palmer and which was being distributed in print form, not only within Michigan's Copper District, but across other places. So with that, I would say thank you and take any questions that you might have.
Well, a tour de force. Now, that comment on grass growing in the streets of Calumet, was that an early comment on Michigan roads from McNaughton?
Probably, yes. We could resurrect it and use it now.
Okay, with that, let me open it up.
I think the answer to that would be yes and no, which is probably the answer you expected from me. I think that the aspects of recognizing unions didn't come at that time. Michigan Copper Companies didn't recognize unions until they were forced to recognize them by the Wagner Act in the 1940s. They I think, did give in on many of the other basic grievances. They did develop a system for grievance. They did change working hours and improve wages. They did not give up on the one-man drill. And I had a student who actually looked at production figures, that looked actually at cost sheets that show working hours and then figure out kind of what the actual costs are, and looked at 1910 versus 1915 at the Quincy Mining Company. And there was actually a reduction of 60% in the cost of drilling, that one piece. Now, there's lots of other things that go into the enterprise to produce copper, but a 60% reduction in the cost of one of your central pieces is one that is hard to ignore. And that was not a piece that I don't think the mining companies were ever going to give up and didn't actually, so.
Well, and just one comment. All of the Western mines that were opening up, the big fields, were all open pit mining. So there was a huge difference in terms of the cost structure of mining, because Calumet and Hecla kept on going deeper and deeper underneath Lake Superior, right? So I mean, there were the comparative productivity costs and cost figures really are quite remarkable, aren't they?
Yeah, the only difference there is that during this particular period, Butte was still underground. They had not done any open pit mining in Montana at that point. But, you know, again, it's apples and oranges always when you're comparing things. I think in some ways the visual image of a Butte miner, how many people here have been to Butte, Montana? You know, it's not actually that different than Calumet. It's a little bit bigger. But I could also imagine if you were living in housing communities in Butte, they were quite different. And so seeing photographs, as we saw here in this presentation, of nice-looking frame housing with kids playing in the yard in a garden is maybe a little bit contrary to what they were seeing as they looked out of their window. Just prop it a little bit.
Julie?
Only at the very beginning of the district. And again, you have to remember, this is a district that opens in the 1840s, and there's really nothing in the copper country in the 1840s, 1850s. The towns that we know only really begin to emerge in the late 1850s, 1860s. And so it really is incumbent on a company to provide everything. You know, if you go to a place like Cliff or Central in the 1850s when mining was starting, there are not a lot of options for banks, for stores. So of necessity, that early, pretty antebellum period, if you look at the mining company records, you'll see that the mining company books were being used as de facto savings accounts. Men would be paid into an account. They could draw cash. You can actually see people paying each other. You know, a guy buys a dog from his neighbor, and you see this exchange through the account books. Quincy operated a company-owned store in Hancock. At the mine site for many years, you know, the indications seemed to be that it was provided out of convenience and that you could bill purchases and into this account system. It seems to me, at least, that most historians agree that it was not used as the kind of control feature that we see of an era in the Pennsylvania coal fields or even in some of the other mining districts in the West, and that very quickly other stores supplement that need, and the companies don't continue to operate them. In fact, Quincy sells its store on Quincy Hill to a private enterprise that operates it independently, and employees are not allowed to bill to the store through their accounts. In Calumet, the cooperative associations are very successful. Tamarack Cooperative had, I think, 6 locations in the Calumet, Laurium, Lake Linden area. And was very successful at keeping prices low and providing people the opportunity to even compete against privately owned enterprises. So I don't get the impression from my reading and my hearing that stores were used as a control feature. But I think, as I said earlier, anything you can do to keep prices low means that you can keep wages low. And so low-price housing, low-price cooperative goods, certainly encourages a company to say, well, you know, it's pretty cheap to live here. In fact, I think Michigan Tech still uses that ploy to this day. Although I think most employees would argue against it, there really are not that many things that are cheaper to do anywhere anymore.
Other questions?
How did the supply of housing compare to the demand? And what other options do the workers have?
You know, there were lots of other options, and I didn't get into them here, but I think it was an area where supply and demand were meeting each other. I think today it's been a problem because of population decline and even housing market value. This is an area, if you go to it today, you can buy a house for $10,000, and not a bad house at that, just because there was so much that was built in an area that had a very large population at one time. In addition to company houses and the ability to build a home on company land, there were all sorts of housing options in the towns that were not controlled by the company. Lots of upstairs accommodation, you know, apartments and rentals above storefronts in the towns and cities. And then you had some towns that developed in each place. There were entrepreneurs, just as we have today. The town of South Range, which is in the center of the Copper Range Company, areas south of Houghton. I'm trying to think, Copper City to the north and the village of Amik. Those were all built by entrepreneurs who bought up property between mining locations and platted a town, sold plots, or even developed spec housing like we would see today. Copper City is a great example of a place that was built because nobody owned the property and the streetcar line went through there. So you could, as a miner, buy a plot of land, build a house, and ride the streetcar to your workplace at a pretty affordable rate. So there were options. I'd refer you to some of the work that Kim Hoagland has done. She's just a much better architectural historian and goes into much more detail than a lowly archivist might achieve. But
Lori?
It's a good question to ask, and I don't know that I have a great answer for you. Mining companies, not surprisingly, are like most corporations, where they reveal what they have to reveal. You know, the compulsion to respond doesn't necessarily include a compulsion to be honest about it. That said, mining companies, even in this era, early in the 20th century, were meeting more requirements for reporting in lots of different federal and state agencies. I tend to think that if anything, the question for them would be, what does inflating or deflating a number get you or not get you? It's a pretty easy game to try to figure out. I think as far as the housing numbers go, I think they're probably pretty accurate. I think the mining companies definitely saw themselves as providing something that they were not making money back on. And so I think they were pleased to show and maybe inflated the number of houses that they owned. But I think also for Palmer, who came up and was on the ground, there had to be a certain amount of truthing. In addition to the photographs, things like aid funds and ground rents actually included in the reports are copies of the lease documents that the company used. So you could actually see, it may be a blank, but at least you could actually see what the actual wording of the lease was. In the case of aid funds, aid funds are a great topic in copper country history because a lot of Cornish miners brought this tradition of miners paying money into an aid fund and the company employing a doctor or running a hospital or some sort of medical aid. And they would actually publish these little books about the aid fund. It was almost like a little rule book. You pay in this much money and you have available to you these things. Some companies that was only available to the employee. Other companies you might be able to take your family there. If your wife was pregnant, you could take her into the doctor and they would deliver a baby. There's additional documentation within that questionnaire which helps to support that, I think. And then on top of it all, these are corporations that are publishing annual reports. We could talk a lot about how you define what production is in a year. But again, those numbers are I think, backed up by other places as well. So I'd probably have a more than reasonably favorable thought that the numbers were realistic, but it's a good question.
JR, and then over to Vivian?
Yeah. Oh,
no,
Jay.
Okay. Oh, no.
I would say definitely in the early years. I mean, you're going out to a place that's remote from other established towns. You're going to a place probably originally that had no easy transportation connections to nearby towns. Nearby can be a very relative thing in the middle of a copper country winter. You know, as far as even going a couple of miles somewhere could be difficult to do. I think there's also a component to it that as the companies mature, this idea that you want your workforce close to the work site so that they're not as dependent upon transportation. or maybe unreliable transportation, that the idea of having them close is to your advantage. I think there's lots of literature that shows that affordable company housing also becomes part of this loyalty relationship through corporate paternalism. The other piece that's at play may be different than some other types of industries. I'm looking at the mural in the back with this great depiction of lumber on the right, is that, you know, lumber is a pretty transient activity. You know, you come in, you cut down trees, and you're out of there, and you move on. So I think also with mining, there's a sense that you're going to be in a place a bit longer. And particularly with Copper Country mining, you know, you're talking about maybe an operation like Calumet and Hecla that starts in the 1860s and operates through the 1960s, 100 years of mineral extraction out of the same ore body. Or you look at a place like Quincy, you know, that had a long history of ore production in the exact place that they started, and you have a very different type of landscape that's affected by long-term presence than you might in a lumber area or a commercial fishing town or something like that. And that's also true if you travel in the American West. The boom-bust cycle for silver and gold deposits can be very short. And so a town can be built in a couple of years. It may only live a decade or even 20 years, and then it's been abandoned for 100 years. And so the ravages of time catch up with a place like that very differently. As they like to say in the Copper Country, though, if you don't live in a house, it only takes about 3 winters to take down a roof, you know, if you don't keep up a place. And so I think the last 50 years have been more damaging to the Copper Country because there hasn't been that presence of mining to the extent that there was the 100 years before it.
Just a quick aside, I believe, and other people in the room might know more about this, but we have a number of Michigan company towns, Vivian. For example, the Fayette site on the Garden Peninsula, NEMA, which is just a few miles away from it, was a company town that was lumbering the mill site rather than the actual site of harvesting the trees. So I think that there's a variety of ones in Michigan history, Pullman in Chicago. I mean, so we've got a number of them, but I think that mining districts are unique because often they're in the middle of nowhere with no real opportunity to be able to get there. I mean, most of the people that made it to the Copper Country came originally by boat, right? I mean, mm-hmm. I think that so because the fact that it was the only way that you were really going to get in and out, and that was only so many months per year. JR?
I should say there's also a great story seeking a lot of research, which is the development of the White Pine Mine in Ontonagon County, where a whole new community was built around this mine in the 1950s. Mm-hmm. Not the 1860s, not the 1890s, but in an era when we think differently about it. You can also look at I'm trying to think, is it Two Harbors, Minnesota, you know, which was built in the, you know, 1980s as a new mineral stamping and port town, you know, up in the Arrowhead of Minnesota. We still build company towns very regularly, and some of them are built to last, some of them are expected to live a short period of time. My wife and I went up to Elliott Lakes, Ontario, which I don't think anybody here probably has ever heard of it. It's in the middle of nowhere, quote unquote, between Sault Ste. Marie and Sudbury. And this was an area that had a very high grade ore deposit of uranium. So during the Cold War, it became this significant mining area to extract uranium. And Canada, Ontario has a great history of dealing with company towns, and they required the manufacturers, the creators of this uranium mining district, to build a community that would survive the end of mining. Sadly, when you go there now, there's nothing to tell you that mining ever happened there, except I think the Canadian Mining Hall of Fame may still be there, although I think it's moving. But they specifically went into this area to build this community to support mining with the understanding that mining would leave the place. It's now a retirement community. What is it? The Gang of Four is the famous art group that paints that area of Ontario, and you can now go up and do painting retreats there and things like that. So anyway, sorry, I got offline. I think John was next.
Jer?
More questions. I have three. I'll make it real quick. One, comparatively trained versus boat arrival.
Not within the mining company owned areas. You could, I mean, they own the land, so, but you could go off there into these town sites that were platted, or you could buy property, loose property outside of those areas. It's more a matter of how do you get to work then. There were lots of examples of particularly Scandinavian immigrants who worked the mines during the winter and then gave their papers and went out and farmed a 40-acre plot during the relatively short growing season of the copper country.
So would they be renters in the company housing during?
It depended on what their situation was, but they could be a renter, or they could take the man could take a room in a boarding house, or an empty room in a Kim Hoagland again has a very great piece looking at the role of women boarding house moms, and looks at how the wife's ability to earn money, because she was really the boss of that house. The men were not only paying for a room, she was doing their laundry, she was making their meals, she was, you know, preparing their lunch pails to go in. I think some of Kim's research uncovered that very often a well-run home, a well-run mining company house, the woman through that work could be earning actually more money than the man was. And that, again, that became part of this movement that they had as a family toward a different life, or a different life for their children. So that was two questions.
John mentioned about boat, and I wondered boat versus train.
Oh,
I think early boat was preferable for a lot of folks.
Rail doesn't arrive to the copper country till 1885 and doesn't reach Calumet until a few years after that.
I guess that relates to my third question. What do you consider to be the boom years of CNH? Because, yeah, it's open for 100 years, but it's not that same until maybe.
I would say I'm just going on recollection, probably 1875 to maybe 1930, to the Depression. It's a company that declares $10 million dividends in 1900, which is a lot of money. Don't be fooled. Tamarack Mining Company, we had this house at Tamarack location. Their original owners were smart enough to kind of figure out the geology, and so they bought property to the northwest where they thought the ore body was going to go, and they sank a shaft, I think it was over 2,000 feet straight down. Everybody thought they were lunatics. They put a lot of money up front to do that, and they hit the ore body pretty much where they expected and when they did, and the next year they declared $1 million dividend. You know, it's big money, very serious corporate activity.
Phil? How many of these company-built houses are still standing and
livable? Standing and livable, those are two very different questions. I would say thousands. And it really depends on how you define company-built house or company-owned house, but there's a lot of them there. Calumet Laurium area probably has several hundred. You go up on the hill at Quincy, still probably 100 or so houses mixed around different little neighborhoods, but definitely down around the Copper Range towns, Painesdale, around South Range, but Tri-Mountain, Baltic, I'd say easily several hundred.
Most occupied.
And also, maybe unfortunate to the historic preservation people, many that are gone that have been replaced with infill that isn't historic. So it can be a pretty hodgepodge drive around those places. Also, not surprisingly, very affordable. Even in the 1950s, as Copper Range was coming out of their kind of desire to be a major producer, they sold houses off very affordably to the owners that were in them. The houses are still very affordable. And so it can also attract people who don't have as much of an interest in living in a historic home, and are cutting firewood in their backyard, or have, put blue tarp over the roof because it has a hole in it. And so it can have kind of a mixed view. This is not the historic community that you might expect. I could say if you're up there, if you keep driving north up 41 into Keweenaw County, the former Central Mine location is now owned predominantly by the Keweenaw County Historical Society. And they've been slowly renovating the remaining buildings that are there, which are probably more like a dozen or 20. But great interpretation there, where you can see this community that once had, you know, maybe 300 structures in it, and now has about a dozen. But you can definitely get a feel, and it has more of a historic feel to it because they're renovating and preserving the structures in a more coordinated manner.
I think we'd be remiss if we didn't mention, for those of you who aren't maybe aware of it, that on Christmas Eve 1913, 74 people, 59 of them children, were killed when a false cry of fire during a striking children's Christmas party resulted in a stampede where the various folks were killed. I only raise that to be able to raise Ludlow, because often Calumet and Ludlow are, in fact, Mother Bleuler wrote a chapter in her autobiography, We Are Many, called The Slaughter of the Innocents or whatever, and it was about Ludlow and Calumet, since she happened to be in both locations. Because in Ludlow, only, I believe, if I remember rightly, 13 people died, mm-hmm. but it was after all of the strikers were, many of them were evicted from company housing and were living in a tent village, tent colony at that time, and that was then attacked by National Guard. But can you comment, do you think that because of the fact that they didn't evict, because that in fact there's a kind of a better history for mine owners, do you think they come off better than Rockefeller and the rest did in relation to Ludlow?
I would say yes. I don't know if it was their intention. It may have more to be with Patrick O'Brien, not necessarily allowing that to be a tool for management to quash a strike. I don't know if I'd really want to respond to that question. I don't know for sure.
Okay. Other questions or comments on the presentation?
Great. Very happy to talk to people afterwards. Just come on up and say hello, and thank you for coming out today. It's nice to see you.
Well, let's give another round of applause, please. See you next Monday, same place, for Maria Katera, and do come to Phil Ritterman's nighttime lecture on the 23rd. Thank you for coming.